Good afternoon. It's Mountain Edition. I'm Allison Bektesh.
And I'm Wyatt Orm. A young couple from Aspen, very much loved by their community, died while climbing Capitol Peak earlier this week.
The Forest Service released a plan that will drastically reduce crowds at Hanging Lake.
Garfield County discusses their need for a detox facility.
And did you take your eclipse glasses selfie? Hundreds of locals gathered to see 92% totality in Aspen on Monday. And did you take your eclipse glasses selfie? Hundreds of locals gathered to see 92% totality in Aspen on Monday.
Those stories and more coming up on Mountain Edition.
The U.S. Forest Service has received three objections to a plan that would limit overnight use of the Maroon Bells Snowmass Wilderness. Elizabeth Stewart Severy has the details.
The plan sets a cap on the number of groups who can camp in the wilderness area. Phase one involves a reservation system for the popular Conundrum Hot Springs and along Conundrum Creek. That would begin next summer. Peter Hart is an attorney for the environmental nonprofit Wilderness Workshop. He says the group filed an objection to ensure they have a voice leading up to the final decision. Wilderness Workshop has voiced strong support for the plan. The other two objections are from individuals who frequently camp at Conundrum Hot Springs. The Forest Service has 45 days to resolve the objections before issuing a final decision. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
After dropping his bid for governor last month, Democratic Colorado Congressman Ed Perlmutter now says he will seek re-election for his House seat after all. Benta Berkland has more.
Perlmutter had originally said he wasn't going to seek re-election. The change of heart put Democrats running to replace him in a bind. It was expected to be a competitive primary race with four individuals, including three sitting state lawmakers. Democratic State Senator Dominic Moreno of Commerce City was the first to suspend his campaign. Moreno says he's personally disappointed, but didn't want to compete with a sitting member of Congress.
I ran because it was an open seat, and it was an opportunity to continue to serve my community at a different level. I've never had any interest in challenging Congressman Perlmutter because I think he's done a great job.
Democratic State Representative Brittany Pedersen of Lakewood also ended her race on Monday. Colorado's 7th congressional district spans Denver's northern and western suburbs. Last election, Perlmutter won with 55% of the vote. Republicans are already blasting him for his indecision on seeking re-election. I'm Benta Berkland at the state capitol.
Governor John Hickenlooper has unveiled new recommendations related to oil and gas drilling in the wake of a fatal home explosion that killed two men. But to some, the measures don't go far enough. Again, Benta Berkland.
The explosion happened in mid-April in Firestone, which is about 30 miles north of Denver. The home was 200 feet from an active oil and gas well. Governor Hickenlooper is proposing expanding an existing program that would allow homeowners to track oil and gas pipelines under their property.
They're an improvement. It's better than what we have now, so it's going in the right direction. They still fall short of the transparency that a lot of people want, though.
That's Democratic Representative Mike Foote of Lafayette. He says he'd prefer an online state map that anyone in the public could use to check for flow lines. The governor says an online map would have security concerns. Hickenlooper also wants to set up a fund to plug abandoned wells and provide in-home methane monitors. I'm Benta Berkland.
Hanging Lake in Glenwood Canyon is one of Colorado's most popular hikes, and overuse is causing degradation to the fragile ecosystem. The U.S. Forest Service released a plan yesterday for how to manage visitors at the trail. Elizabeth Stewart Severy discussed the goals of the new plan with producer Kristen Kay.
So Elizabeth, how will the Forest Service address overuse at Hanging Lake?
The plan sets a cap of 615 hikers per day on the trail year-round, as well as a mandatory shuttle during peak season from May to October. So there will be a fee-based reservation system to limit the number of people on the trail, which will probably be enforced by a ranger at the trailhead. Aaron Mayville, who is the district ranger for the area, is quick to point out that the plan is adaptive. That is, the Forest Service can change the numbers if they see that 615 is still too many people, or they can actually adjust up if they find the area can accommodate more.
And what's the goal of this new plan?
The first definitely is to protect the ecosystem. In addition, they need to reduce traffic and congestion and also make sure that these changes don't negatively impact the tourist economy around Hanging Lake.
And how much of a change is this really? So what does current use look like?
Well, in 2016, the Forest Service says that about 150,000 people visited Hanging Lake. The parking lot is full and chaotic. There are long lines on the trails, and all of it is causing real damage both to the ecosystem actually along the trail as people try to take shortcuts or move around the crowds, and at the lake, which is this fragile travertine. So anyway, in peak season, over 1,000 people a day are headed up to the lake, which means a 40% reduction during those most popular times. And part of the idea is to spread out visitation both across the year and across the day by having reserve time so that not everyone is trying to go up there at like 10 a.m. on a Saturday.
Mm-hmm. So there are tons of visitors, some damage to the ecosystem. Is it possible to protect this area and allow people to continue to visit?
Yeah, and I think that's actually part of a bigger conversation about how to balance recreation and preservation of public lands. The White River National Forest is actually the most visited forest in the country. And as Mayville points out, this is actually a good conversation to be having.
The more people that can be out and enjoy public land, not just to enjoy them, but to understand why they exist, ultimately to steward them and to, you know, perpetuate the great idea that of the public land system in this country.
So yeah, it's a challenge, but it might be a good one to have.
So what about costs and logistics of this new plan? Do we know those details?
Not yet. The Forest Service did take extensive surveys and found that people tend to be in general supportive of the idea of a fee system, but they want to gather more feedback before they set a price. The plan is really the start of the Forest Service process called NEPA. It kicks off a 30-day public comment period. We'll see a couple midstream steps, and then the final decision is expected in December.
Thanks, Elizabeth.
You're welcome.
One morning in late July, a couple was leaving their apartment in Glenwood Springs. They were almost to their car when they were surrounded by agents from ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The young woman watched as they led her boyfriend away in handcuffs. Wyatt has the story of Adon Serrano. He was one of the scores arrested around the state during a nationwide ICE surge. Some names in the story have been changed for privacy.
Three women sit on couches in a small apartment in Glenwood Springs. They're calm, but they're all fighting back tears.
I just don't want him to be taken away.
That's Ayaleen. She's 19. Adon, her boyfriend, is 26. At the moment, he's being held at a detention center in Aurora. Adon's sisters, Glenda and Sara, sit across from Ayaleen. They're scared and anxious, but they're not surprised.
Y obviamente entramos ilegal.
Obviously, we came here illegally. I feel like it's bad to say this, but it's the truth.
Adon and his sisters came from El Salvador at different times. He was 16 when he arrived. He had no choice but to leave, his sisters say. Gangs in El Salvador recruit kids. Here's Adon's sister, Glenda.
And if the kids don't join the gangs, they get killed, or the gangs will hurt their families.
She says Adon and his best friend were recruited, but they said no. The best friend was murdered, and Adon fled the country. Glenda says in 2007, Adon applied for asylum, but convincing a judge in a case like his is tough.
It takes basically a Hail Mary.
Catherine Chan is Adon's lawyer. She's based in Denver. The judge refused Adon's claim. He was supposed to leave the country, but didn't. This resulted in a deportation order. But he continued living his life, with the threat hovering over him. Then came Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump. Here he is in 2016, speaking to a crowd in Phoenix, Arizona.
There will be no amnesty.
ICE released a statement during the surge in which Adon was detained. They said they were targeting undocumented people with criminal histories or with suspected gang ties. Adon has a criminal history. In 2012, he pled guilty to providing alcohol to minors. He was charged with a misdemeanor. But, ICE said, the surge was also targeting families and people who came here as children.
I mean, that means anything or anyone.
Sophia Clark works for CIRC. It's a statewide immigrant rights organization. She's the point person for the Rocky Mountain region. For those who think Adon's arrest is unique to the Trump era, think again, she says.
This is nothing new.
Obama deported record numbers of undocumented immigrants over his time in office. Under Obama, though, Clark says at least she and her colleagues could have a dialogue with ICE. ICE has discretion. They choose when and how to use their authority. Clark says she used to be able to advocate for people ICE arrested. Before Trump, she could appeal to ICE. She could make a case for someone they just put in detention. Now, she says,
there's nothing to push back on. There's no accountability.
Back at the apartment in Glenwood Springs, Eileen and Adan's sisters are ready to throw their own Hail Mary.
We already had the plan of possibly getting married, so I'm going down there to see if I can find a judge or something to marry us tomorrow.
As his spouse, she hopes to have firmer ground to stand on when she asks ICE not to send Adan away. She goes to the detention center the next day.
When you first walk in, it's just like a waiting room. It's just a bunch of
She's frustrated. There's more paperwork to do before she and Adan can get married. And even if it all gets done and they get married, does it matter? Again, Catherine Chan, Adan's attorney.
Will anybody at ICE or the government lawyer's office or the appellate agency in immigration? No, nobody there cares at all.
Adan and Eileen did not get married. He was deported a little over a week ago. This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Wyatt Orm. In case you didn't know already, Aspen Public Radio is on Facebook. Like our page for updates on our latest events, pictures of the Aspen Public Radio team, and links to important stories we're reporting on. Go to Facebook and search Aspen Public Radio, or just go to facebook.com/aspenradio to like the page and start getting our updates. Governor John Hickenlooper launched a new initiative this year. It's called Take Note Colorado, and its aim is to give every K-12 student in the state access to musical instruments and education. As Claire Woodcock reports, the Roaring Fork School District is one of a handful being tested throughout the state.
Roaring Fork School District is made up of 12 schools in Basalt, Carbondale, and Glenwood Springs. Karen Radman is executive director of Colorado Music Coalition, a new nonprofit overseeing the Take Note Colorado initiative.
Most of the elementary schools don't offer any access to instruments.
Money raised at the initiative's kickoff concert in May provide the seed funding for Roaring Fork and four other pilot districts across the state. These funds are expected to help support music education programs this upcoming school year. Colorado Music Coalition will return in October to help the district assess what schools need the most support. Claire Woodcock, Idlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
Before there's a new Grand Avenue Bridge, crews need to get rid of the old one. This project has seen some surprises right out of the gate, considering part of the old bridge collapsed last week as crews worked to dismantle it. To learn more about what happened and to understand what goes into the dismantling of a 50-year-old bridge and what comes out of it, News Director Carolyn Zachariasen sat down with Wyatt.
What happened on Tuesday night?
There's some really good photos and some really good videos of this, but just because we're on the radio, I'm going to describe it to you. So think about this image. Say you've lined up a row of dominoes and you've laid some chopsticks on top of them. So the chopsticks in this analogy are the steel girders, and the dominoes are the enormous concrete piers that hold up the girders. What crews were trying to do on Tuesday evening was to carefully slide the chopsticks off the dominoes without knocking any over. But one domino fell, and the chopsticks went with it. So in the collapse, one of the girders, or the chopsticks, hit one of the piers on the new bridge, and it bent some of the rebar, and the people in charge are still assessing that damage.
How are they going to make sure that this doesn't happen again?
They already have a different plan to remove the rest of the girders. So a crane is going to take those off one by one instead of, you know, sliding them. They've also strung this huge tarp underneath the bridge above the river and above the interstate such that no debris falls and puts anybody in danger.
Okay, so once they've taken it down, where does it all go?
By the time crews are done, they will have hauled out around 170 truckloads of material. And this is 2,000 cubic yards of concrete along with the steel girders and other bits of material. Their crews are cutting up the deck of the bridge into these 5-foot by 20-foot sections, which they then put into this machine called a muncher, and it breaks up the concrete. All the concrete is going to a recycling plant in Rifle, and there they'll just use it to make gravel and other stuff like that. The steel girders and the rebar, they're going to a mill in Pueblo. They're going to be melted down and then reused, and apparently they'll be made into new railroad rails and also into more rebar.
Is there any part of the old bridge that they're going to use for the new bridge?
No. I asked Tom Newland this question. Tom Newland is CDOT's public information manager for the bridge. And he basically said, no, we're getting it all out and bringing new stuff in.
What kind of materials are showing up for the new bridge then?
4.3 million pounds of steel is coming, 30,000 square feet of stone and brick, and a little over 7,000 cubic yards of new concrete. That is what will make up the new Grand Avenue Bridge.
Okay, thanks, Wyatt.
You're welcome.
Wyatt, what's new with the bridge this week?
So I just spoke with Tom Newland on the phone. Tom Newland is CDOT's public relations manager, and he said that it looks like wait times on I-70 are down. It sounds like either people are getting up earlier in the morning and coming in, or more and more people are using the bus. So things are looking up, although there is still quite a bit of traffic.
All right, thank you. On to other forms of transportation, the Pickens County Board of Commissioners heard an update on Tuesday about the potential environmental impacts from a proposed expansion at the airport. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy reports.
Airport Director John Kinney and consultant Rick Dunkelberg presented findings from an FAA-funded and required environmental assessment on two proposed projects, a new terminal building and a relocated runway. The runway would be moved 80 feet to the west to accommodate larger aircraft, and that would mean damage to wetlands near Owl Creek Road. Mitigation efforts would be coordinated with the Army Corps of Engineers. The assessment also considered air and water quality, wildlife, noise, and more. These all fell within the federal thresholds for environmental impacts. The draft document will be released for public review within a week, and there will be public meetings in Aspen and Snowmass next month. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
It's no longer illegal to break into a hot vehicle to rescue a child or dog. A new law went into effect earlier this month that waives liability for a Good Samaritan. Benta Berkland has more.
The law requires someone to first try other options, such as unlocking the door and calling 911. But if a Good Samaritan chooses to break down a window, they won't be liable. Republican Representative Lori Sane of Firestone is one of the main sponsors of the bipartisan bill. She says it's common sense. The measure aims to educate people on how quickly cars can reach searing temperatures. According to the nonprofit Kids and Cars, 37 children have died from heat stroke this year after being trapped inside a vehicle. I'm Benta Berkland at the State Capitol.
The bodies of Carlin Brightwell and Ryan Marcil were found at the base of Capitol Peak's north face on Tuesday by search and rescue teams. The couple, both in their late 20s, had just moved in together in downtown Aspen. Allison talked with Kristen Kay, our producer, about this local loss.
You've been speaking with close friends of the couple. What are they saying about Carly and Ryan?
I want to start with what one source wrote to me. It is always a joy of a small community to know your neighbors, but yet again, it can also be the heartache. And of course, that's what we're experiencing here in such a small town and such a small valley. The loss of a single person is going to have a ripple that affects hundreds and hundreds of other lives. Carly's friends were together taking care of each other on Tuesday night when this news came out. They wrote up a joint statement, and I think for those of us who did know Carly from the neighborhood or were taken care of by her at the Emporium and Flying Circus, can picture her smile as you hear these words. Carlin appreciated every ray of sunshine, every snowflake that fell, and every breath she took. Her and Ryan were two rays of sunshine that this town will forever miss. Ryan came out to the Valley as a reset from his life back east. He threw himself into service and had been a member of the Aspen Strong Board. He became almost a little brother to its founder, Christina King. I spent the morning with her yesterday. Here's what she said about his work with the organization.
It wasn't about putting his face out there. It was about letting this community know that there is help, that there is support. We're grieving so much on the Aspen Strong team, but we're grieving knowing that Ryan, he touched so many people. I was so proud to be standing next to him.
And recently, Carlin had also joined the board of that organization.
Something like this hits our small town pretty hard.
I know it seems like there's been a rise in deaths. We've had six in these close by Elk Mountains this summer, but it's not often that it's a local. The Aspen Hope Center is on hand offering services to anybody who needs them. They're actually typically on hand with every rescue mission. They debrief the Mountain Rescue Aspen team. Those are the local community volunteers who are out there doing these search and recovery missions. And of course, in this case, members of the team knew the people they were looking for.
How can people show their condolences?
A joint memorial service has been set for Carlin and Ryan tomorrow from 5:30 to 7. The families will be there and the community is invited to attend and asked to bring a candle. The family is also asking in lieu of flowers, they donate in Carlin and Ryan's name to the Aspen Strong Foundation that they both cared about so much.
Okay, thank you, Allison.
Thank you, Kristen. You are listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Allison Bektesh. To stay on the know with what's happening with Aspen Public Radio and throughout the community, like our Facebook page and other social media channels. On our Facebook page, you can interact with our station through comments on our posts and by messaging us directly. This is also the place to go for breaking news and other important updates on what's happening in the Valley and statewide. Check it out by searching Aspen Public Radio on Facebook.
Mountain Film in Aspen started on Wednesday at the Wheeler Opera House. As Claire Woodcock reports, this year's festival will be the biggest yet.
Over the course of 5 days, the Wheeler Opera House and Mountain Film will present about 20 feature and short films. Jenna Bueller is executive director of the Wheeler. She says these films are all very character-based.
And we really focus on stories that help to shape activism or reaction or just tell a really amazing story of what we call the indomitable spirit.
This year's festival will include a new shorts program called The New Normal, which tackles climate change. This program will be paired with new lunch sessions throughout the week. Claire Woodcock, Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
Hundreds of curious spectators in Aspen showed up to view the partial eclipse on Monday. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy has more.
More than 500 people lined up in front of the Pitkin County Library hours before the eclipse reached its peak at 11:43 a.m. Most were looking for the special glasses that filter out nearly all visible light, as well as the UV and infrared light that damages the eye. The Aspen Science Center handed out 500 pairs. The crowd that gathered for the Science Center's celebration shared glasses, peered through telescopes, and used pinhole cameras to watch as the moon occluded about 92% of the sun.
Dang, that's so crazy.
Temperatures dropped noticeably near that peak. A total solar eclipse will pass over the Roaring Fork Valley in 2045. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
Earlier this week, Garfield County's Board of Commissioners met to discuss their lack of a detox facility.
Someone who's withdrawing from drugs or alcohol, or both, can experience uncomfortable, even life-threatening symptoms. If they're in Garfield County, the emergency room is their only option. Ben Pieri from Valley View Hospital described the problem this way.
We are your detox center. And
this costs the hospital, and it doesn't do much to address underlying substance abuse issues. Commissioners seemed open to footing the bill to use recovery resources in Aspen, which serves as Pitkin County's detox. Even if it's not a long-term solution, it's a start, said Commissioner Tom Jankowski.
Last week, Pitkin County public health officials warned of an increase in bat activity after 11 were found dead in snowmass. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy reported on the story and sat down with Kristen Kay to follow up.
So I think one concern here for a lot of people who heard that story might be that bats can carry rabies. How common is that?
Well, only 1% of bats actually carry rabies, so it is quite rare. But the concern is real because rabies is fatal nearly 100% of the time. I talked with Kurt Dahl, who is Pitkin County's environmental health manager, and he said that the county sent out a notice so that people can be a bit more conscientious.
Did any of the 11 dead bats in snowmass test positive for rabies?
No, they didn't. And in 5 years, Dahl said, Pitkin County has only had one bat test positive for rabies. The bats in snowmass were apparently killed by a house cat, which also highlights why it's important to keep your pet's vaccinations current.
Okay, so what does Pitkin County recommend that people do when they do encounter a bat?
Okay, so if you see a bat outside in its natural environment, just let it be. Bats are actually really important to the ecosystem. They're pollinators and insect eaters, and it's important that they just be left alone. But if a bat gets into your home or another enclosed space, you should call animal control and try to keep the bat contained. especially if there's a chance that you've been bitten, like if you wake up with a bat in your room, which does happen. Bats' teeth are so small that you can't always see or feel a bite, and rabies is transmitted through their saliva. So in a case like that, you really want the bat tested. It's also a good idea to call animal control if you find a dead bat so they can test it too.
So if you come into contact with a bat that does end up testing positive for rabies, what should you do?
Well, rabies needs to be treated immediately, well before a person shows symptoms. So here's how Kurt Dahl puts it.
You have to get post-exposure prophylaxis prior to showing symptoms, because once you start showing symptoms and the disease has progressed that far, the fatality rate is essentially 100%.
And that captures why the county would issue a statement and an alert even when no bats have tested positive this year.
That's a good reminder. I have one question. Mm-hmm. What kind of cat kills 11 bats?
A good hunter, but apparently it's not terribly uncommon. Kurt Dahl says that the Colorado Parks and Wildlife veterinarian has seen up to 30 bats killed by a single house cat.
Dog lovers are just going to use that for another argument for dogs as pets, I think.
Dr. Daniel Levitin is a cognitive neuroscientist, professor, writer, and musician. He's known for several best-selling books, including This Is Your Brain on Music, The Science of a Human Obsession. His latest book is called Weaponized Lies, How to Think Critically in the Post-Truth Era. Claire Woodcock sat down with him last week to discuss the ongoing conversation about fake news.
What made you want to get involved in that conversation?
Well, I started writing this book in 2001. I noticed that the undergraduate students that I taught and a number of the high school and junior high school students that I would interact with weren't getting the kind of training in critical thinking that I benefited from as a kid. Somewhere around 2014, after I had started writing the book, I doubled down and started working on it in earnest. And what I wanted to pull together was a real practical guide, something that everybody could use. And by everybody, I mean pretty much anybody in eighth grade on up could get something out of the book. It wouldn't be bogged down in theory. This is what you do when you read a headline or when you see a post on Facebook. You hear something on an NPR affiliate station. How do you know whether it's true or not? And what if your friends are telling you that it's fake news? What can you do to figure out for yourself?
In the book, you trace back to a flaw in the education system, citing several times that after the second grade, kids begin to read less and less. What brought you to that conclusion?
Well, I think the flaw in the education system is that the primary mission of K through 12 education was to load up young, impressionable minds with facts and figures. But we got the internet. And so these facts and figures, which used to be very hard and time-consuming to locate in a pre-internet world, are suddenly available immediately. So what we failed to do was realize that K through 12 education should be less about shoving facts and figures into young minds, because the kids are going to get it on their own.
Uh-huh.
It should be more about how to determine whether the information you're encountering is actually true and valid or not, and how to use it creatively to make society and the world a better place.
Well, I'm going to fact check everything that
you have
said.
I hope you will. I expect nothing less.
But thank you so much for taking the time to come into the studio today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Dr. Daniel Levitin, a cognitive neuroscientist and writer who was in Aspen last week discussing his latest book, Weaponized Lies, How to Think Critically in the Post-Truth Era. I'm Claire Woodcock at the Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
That's all for this week's Mountain Edition. I'm Wyatt Orm.
And I'm Allison Bechtesh. To hear this show again or subscribe to our Mountain Edition podcast, head to our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune in tomorrow at 3:30 for Valley Roundup. News director Carolyn Zachariasen talks with a panel of local journalists about this week's news.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.